Accession number 18801, real one.
Mr. Vic May, real one.
Well, my name is Victor May, Victor John May, born Wokingham, Berkshire, 25th September 1917. My father was an accountant in the local small municipal gas company, and because of that he was reserved in the First World War. My education started in the local church elementary school, Palmer School, Wokingham. I rapidly went from the bottom class to the top class in a matter of 4.5 years. In 1927, when I was about nine and a half, I sat a scholarship examination for a local grammar school in Bracknell, Berkshire. And it's worth noting that in the whole of Berkshire, there were 18 scholarships to grammar school in the whole county, excluding Reading. I managed to get third out of the 18 before the age of 10. Because of that, they put a time limit on the succeeding years and said one must be 10 or over to enter the scholarship examination. I therefore went to Ranelagh School, Bracknell, as a scholarship boy in September 1927. I stayed there for 8 years. My chief interests were Boy Scouts and hockey, slightly. In 1935, I was awarded another Berkshire scholarship to enter Reading University to study maths and physics. I went to Reading for 3 years and obtained a second-class degree in 1938. During my time at Reading, I was interested in scouting. I played hockey for the university second 11, was captain, I believe, and the officers' training corps. In those years, the prospect of war seemed more and more likely, and the majority of able-bodied male students joined the officers' training corps. It was a small university in those days, total number of students about 650, and probably more females than males, therefore a good proportion of the males were in the OTC. I managed to pass my certificates A and B and became a platoon commander in the OTC. In fact, I was awarded a prize for the most proficient cadet in the OTC in 1938, which surprised me, I must say. At the end of my time in the OTC, we had to sign a kind of gentleman's agreement that in the event of emergency, we would offer our services to the government or the king or both. In 1938, I had decided to become a school teacher, but the education diploma course at Reading was full for that year, so I had to fill in a year before being accepted in October 1939. During that year, I went to a refugee school in Hazelmere, known as Stoke the Rough. Almost all the pupils were refugees from Nazi Germany, mostly Germany, some from Poland, some from Austria, and one or two even from Czechoslovakia. They were all refugees in the sense that their parents' businesses, employments ceased to exist. The businesses were destroyed, the synagogues were being destroyed and the Jews were being hounded out of their houses and professions. During my time there, I taught mathematics, a little science, and continued my scouting activities. I left there in August 1939, having run a scout camp in Cornwall in conjunction with a Wokingham scout troop, and we returned a few days before the outbreak of war. When my employment terminated, I then went back to my parents' home in Wokingham, and on Sunday, September the 3rd, 1939, I attended morning service at All Saints Church, Wokingham. The rector, Gordon Kenworthy, took a portable radio to the pulpit, and at 11 a.m., the congregation heard the Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, announce that we were now at war with Germany. The congregation departed in silence, in a rather solemn atmosphere, and I remember my mother saying when I got home, "This is going to ruin a few careers," implying that it was going to ruin my career. Well, on Monday, the following day, Monday, September the 4th, I went to Reading University and had an interview with the Officers' Selection Board. I was granted an interview and I met many ex-students whom I knew in my previous years there. I was asked to select my choice of regiments. I chose Royal Corps of Signals, Royal Artillery, or Royal Berkshire Regiment in that order. And then, of course, I had to wait to see what was happening. On Monday, 25th September 39, in the afternoon, a special delivery letter arrived for me, a registered letter from the War Office, saying, "I am directed to refer to your application for an emergency commission in His Majesty's Land Forces, and to say that you have been selected for appointment as a second lieutenant in the King's Shropshire Light Infantry." I'd never heard of the King's Shropshire Light Infantry, so my three choices had all gone. I was instructed to report to the depot, King's Shropshire Light Infantry, Shrewsbury, on the 1st of October, 39, which gave me 5 days, maybe 6 days. This was in the afternoon of a Monday, and I had to be in Shrewsbury on the following Sunday. It goes on to say, "You are forthwith to take steps to purchase uniform appropriate to the regiment or corps in which you are to be appointed, as given in paragraph 1 above, in accordance with instructions in the enclosed pamphlet, etc." There was no indication about where to go for the uniform, military tailors and so on. There were none in Wokingham, none in Reading that I was aware of. So, as there are a number of retired army officers in Wokingham, I went to one, a Lieutenant General Percy Mallory. He was an ex-commandant of Royal Marines in Chatham and Devonport. And I had a secret little love affair with his daughter, but he didn't know. And he advised me to go to a firm known as Alkett in Cambridge Circus, Charing Cross Road. So the following day, Tuesday, again at my expense, off to military tailors in Charing Cross Road to be measured for my uniform. Then I had to hope that the uniform would arrive before I was due in Shrewsbury. But by the Saturday, only a portion of the uniform came, so I had to roll up that portion in my army bedroll, which I had bought, known as a valise, and prepare myself for the journey to Shrewsbury. On Sunday, October 39, Sunday, 1st of October 39, I had my first class train journey to Shrewsbury, the first time I'd ever travelled first class by train. And when I arrived, I found there were three other officers exactly in the same situation. So we were four emergency commissioned officers reporting for duty in Shrewsbury, Sunday, October 1939. The following day, we were issued with battle dress from the store so that we were in some kind of a uniform. And that same day, accompanied by the adjutant, Captain Geoffrey Musson, who became a general, he gave us some instruction on guard mounting duties and guard inspections. And later we accompanied the CO, Lieutenant Colonel Eager, on an inspection of barracks. In this inspection we strayed into the adjoining army hospital, and there followed an altercation between the CO and the senior medical officer, who was also a lieutenant colonel, and they almost had a pitched battle over their territory. The senior MO said, "Within these four walls I am in sole command," and he chased us out. So we marched smartly across the parade ground to the Nathy, where the other ranks, wives, shot and drew their rations. Well, during October 39, we were given a little basic infantry training in and around the barracks. The warrant officers and NCOs were almost all regular soldiers, I think entirely regular soldiers, and they gave us a little brushing up on military duties and such like. The other officers were a mixed bag. The regular officers were very much county types who went off shooting at weekends and obviously had a little spare cash as well, which I certainly hadn't got. There were also a number of reserve officers who'd had experience of the Great War, and they'd been called up because of the impending emergency. And there were a few territorial officers, so we were very much a mixed bag. Well, the newly appointed officers, that's myself and the other three, we did our basic infantry training, as I said, in and around the barracks. We had a little difficulty over the light infantry pace, which was 140 steps to the minute on formal parades, which was only used on the parade ground and also entering and leaving barracks. When I took my platoon, which had been allotted to me, out of barracks, I forgot this, and we maintained the pace of 140 to the minute for quite a long time, and the unfortunate soldiers were sort of falling out by the wayside, suffering from various cramps and such like. Well, I only did it once, of course. That was quite a humorous lesson to learn. So in future, only 140 to the minute entering and leaving barracks and on the formal parade ground, otherwise ordinary 108 to the minute. Apart from training, some of the soldiers had to go to a place called Shrifnel in Shropshire to dig up potatoes, strangely enough, because although there was a war on and nobody knew quite how the war was going to develop, there were a lot of potatoes in the ground in Shropshire, and nobody to dig them up because the potato diggers had also been called up. So a small contingent of soldiers had to be sent to Shrifnel to dig up potatoes instead of preparing to fight the Germans. We also visited a factory at Wellington in Shropshire where they were making some nautical mines, things to be dropped in the sea or attached to bits of wire in the sea to sink German U-boats or German shipping. November 39, 4 weeks later, and because of an influx of more officers and soldiers, I was transferred from the depot to a place known as the Maltings at Harlescott, still in Shrewsbury, which became an overflow barracks. Well, it was most unsuitable for barracks because the soldiers had to sleep in very dark, low rooms which had been used for malting the barley, very poorly ventilated, very poor lighting, almost impossible to stand upright, most unsuitable, but there was nowhere else, so that became our barracks for the next few weeks. I managed to get a room in the overseer's house adjoining a canal. We continued our training with a bit of emphasis on defence. They were a bit too keen on trench warfare as an overflow from the 1418 war. But to keep us fit, we went on longer and longer route marches, and they also took us on what was known as night operations on the West Church Road, Shrewsbury, which wasn't very exciting or very useful, I don't think. At the end of the month, November, the 8 young officers were ordered to report to the CO's office. And of those 8, 4 were to join the 2nd Battalion in the West Indies, and 4 were to go on course in Aldershot. Needless to say, I was sent to the course in Aldershot. So we, the first 4 to join, went to Aldershot and were posted to something called the O2 Officer Training Unit, which is a bit like an OCTU, but it was for officers, the 169 and the 170-02, at Blenheim Lines, North Camp, Aldershot. I was then billeted in old married quarters known as Napier Square, which had been condemned but still in use, 4 officers per married quarter. During that time, we had more military training, still with emphasis on defence and not attack, and the first contingent of Canadian troops arrived during that spell before Christmas 39, and I remember travelling by bus from North Camp into Aldershot, and the Canadians were quite amazed that the bus drivers could find their way in complete and utter darkness. See, it was dark in December by 5 p.m. There were no headlights on buses or cars. There were some funny hoods with a little glimmer of light shining down like a pocket torch. And there were no street lights and no signposts. And yet these bus drivers managed to drive the mile and a half from North Camp into Aldershot almost without any lights at all. The Canadians thought that was quite amazing. I managed to get a Christmas leave in Wokingham and then back in January to finish the course in Aldershot. At the completion of the course, I then returned to Shrewsbury and found that I was to be posted to Denbigh in North Wales, where there was to be formed something called a holding battalion. It was the 7th Infantry Holding Battalion, and the idea was that it was to hold troops and officers, to train them, and to be prepared to send them to France as reinforcements or replacement of casualties. It was a very odd battalion because the 4 companies were all from 4 different regiments, one from KSLI, one from Royal Welsh Fusiliers, one from Lancashire Fusiliers, and one, I think, from the Cheshire Regiment. I was billeted in great comfort in the Bull Hotel in the centre of Denbigh. The weather was extremely cold, much snow and ice, which interfered with our training. If we took the troops out on route march, it was almost impossible to march on the snow-covered road. The snow had packed and was so slippery. In fact, on the slope, the cunning troops decided to squat down and sort of escape down instead of marching, which was a very sensible thing to do, really. In February 1940, the KSLI company was then sent a few miles north to St. Asaph, which was a small cathedral city, so-called. Although it was a city there, it's no bigger than a small village in southern England. I was then billeted in a guest house called Tullady, and the troops in any available empty properties. The troops had to have their baths in the St. Asaph workhouse, which had once been occupied by H.M. Stanley, journalist and explorer, who was born in a cottage under the slopes of Denbigh Castle. In March 1940, I was appointed battalion signals officer. I'd always been interested in signalling and map reading and such like, so I returned to Denbigh and formed the signal platoon for that 7th Infantry Holding Battalion. As I wasn't a qualified signals officer, in April 1940 they sent me to a regimental signals officer's course in Cashwick, near Richmond in Yorkshire. still very cold in Catterick, even snow. After 6 weeks, I qualified as a regimental signals officer and returned to Denby to continue the training. As time went on, the Dunkirk period was approaching when the evacuation of the British Expeditionary Force from Dunkirk came, and we were prepared to receive troops from Dunkirk, even in Denby. In fact, anyone turned up. The local residents had made fans, they had big welcoming banners saying welcome to the BEF, they even had meals laid on, and only one man turned up. He was a rather shell-shocked major from the Leicestershire Regiment. In June 1940, the 7th Holding Battalion was disbanded and the KSLI company went to Church Stretton in Shropshire to begin the forming of the 7th Battalion King Shropshire Light Infantry. We had completely raw soldiers, so they had to be given basic infantry training, and those who were reasonably intelligent, good at reading and writing and map reading, were selected for the signal platoon. So I was in charge of the signal platoon in Church Stretton in Shropshire. Our training consisted of cable laying, even signalling with flag. Morse and semaphore signalling was still in use in those days. I even tried a heliograph from one of the hills near Church Stretton to Shrewsbury. I managed to get a message through, but they couldn't send it back because there was no sun. The heliograph depends on sunshine at both ends, and although it has a good range, it really was quite impossible and impractical. And this was the days before radio communication had got going. During that time, there was a certain amount of spy fever. People were expecting a German invasion, and it was thought there might have been fifth columnists almost all over the country, especially where there were likely landing grounds for German planes or gliders. And one such likely place was the Longwind, which is a large hill feature to the west of Church Stretton, which is very flat on top, and there had been a gliding club there in in pre-war days. And some of the locals said there were some Germans at that gliding club, they knew a thing or two, they're going to land on the Longwind. Well, in conjunction with the local Home Guard, we arranged to have an observation point on top of the Longwind in case the Germans did in fact land in June, July 1940. But no radio, no telephones, almost no equipment. So the Home Guard system of warning was that the Home Guard observation post should have pigeons. When the Germans landed, a pigeon would be released. That pigeon would home down into Church Stretton. It would then land at its loft in the back of a public house in Church Stretton, and in so doing, it made electrical contact and rang a bell in the public bar. And when that bell rang, that was the signal for the Home Guard to turn out and for the King's Shropshire Light Infantry to turn out, all depending on the pigeon. Well, it worked in a trial, but we never had to use it, fortunately. Probably the pigeon might have got shot or lost. But that was the sort of situation we were in. We were extremely poorly equipped. The whole battalion of perhaps 600-700 men had 4 light machine guns borrowed from the barracks in Shrewsbury, a few ancient rifles. I believe the Home Guard were even using broomsticks. Although I was a signals officer, they also said I would have to be a liaison officer between the battalion headquarters and the local area headquarters, which was in Ludlow. And to get there, I had to use a motorcycle. Well, we didn't have many vehicles, so there was a system of commandeering all the local vehicles if they were going to be useful. I was allotted the local window cleaner's motorcycle. He had a sidecar, which had the ladders which the window cleaners use, and I had to practice riding this motorbike with a sidecar, which is not too easy at first, but I managed it anyway. And if there had been an invasion, my job was to get on this motorbike and cycle to Ludlow to receive orders for the battalion from the area commander, and then to get on this motorbike and cycle back again to Church Stretton, 12, 15 miles, I believe, each way. But again, that never happened. But I think, had the Germans arrived in late June, July 1940, it would have been a walkover. We had no adequate preparation at all. Fortunately, they didn't come. September 1940, plans were then being prepared for a possible German invasion, serious plans this was, and it was decided that the 7th KSLI could be moved from Church Stretton, Shropshire, where they thought the German landing was not probable, to coast defence. We were then sent to Deal in Kent to defend part of the Kent coast north of Dover, between Dover and Ramsgate, where there was a slight low-lying area where the Romans had landed, a place called Richbudley, and we were to keep the Germans back from Richborough, or Deal, and we were based on Deal. Well, during that time, of course, we were shot at by German aircraft. We were shelled by German guns, because the Germans had naval guns in Calais, and they were actually firing on Dover across the Channel, and the limit was Deal, and some of their shells actually landed on the Royal Marines barracks in Deal, where we were stationed. And my own company commander, Major Gurney Richmond, was killed by shell fire in Deal as a result of this enemy action. During my time in Deal, I was sort of keeping the companies in contact with battalion headquarters by telephone, still no radio, and in the little spare time I had, I got on my bicycle and I actually rode to Dover on my bicycle and saw German planes dropping bombs on Dover, and they got so low that they were below the anti-aircraft guns, which were mounted on the cliffs above Dover. The German planes, being cunning, decided to get below the level of the guns. When that sort of thing happened in Dover, instead of having an air raid warning, the local police would stick a kind of placard in the street saying shell warning, and that indicated that the Germans were about to shell Dover or Deal, and people were advised to take cover accordingly. I also cycled northwards as far as Ramsgate, and I noticed one or two camouflaged gun positions, and I thought perhaps we were going to have a crack at firing guns across the Channel at the Germans in return. But on closer inspection, those guns were in fact telegraph poles, which had been mounted to look like guns and were camouflaged as guns were, and our defence of the Kent coast was telegraph poles. Well, after a few weeks in Deal, we almost got bombed out of the marine barracks because the Germans had a range on their barracks. And once while I was away, my batman, I had a batman in those days, assures me that he was blown out of a window, a second floor window. And before he landed on the playground down below, another another bomb or shell went off, which cushioned his landing, and he just suffered from shock and no injuries. Well, I hope that was true. It seems very, very unlikely story, but I can assure you that my battle dress that was hanging on the door was blown out of that window and onto the parade ground and was absolutely showered in broken glass and so on. And in that time we had been issued with telephones and a little telephone exchange, and some of that got damaged by shell power and gunpowder.